So we paused last week in our study of matters Masoretic with the introduction of the Ta'amei HaMikra. So I want to pick up from there before we move into some things that I've called Masoretic anomalies. So first of all, the Ta'amei HaMikra. For some reason, I really don't know where it originated. Ta'amei HaMikra are better known amongst Ashkenazim as Trup. So the best that I could come up with is the definition you see on the bottom of the screen, courtesy actually the Oxford English Dictionary, which carries what it calls an obsolete definition of trope as being a manner of playing music, a mode or harmonization. So clearly at some, whatever point in time that trope became the equivalent of Ta'amei HaMikra, it had a recognizable association with things that are musical. In any event, if you look at the four words that are on the screen, we can distinguish through the use of colors between the tinuot, the vowel signs, and the Ta'amei HaMikra, the punctuation marks. What you see in red are the vowel signs, the vocalization. That tells us how those different consonants are to be pronounced. What you see in blue are the Ta'amei HaMikra, the punctuation marks, which tell us, which give us the understanding of how the words associate with one another, which words are to be read in conjunction with each other, as opposed to which words are to be kept separate from each other. So one of the earliest observations that we have on the use of Ta'amei HaMikra comes to us courtesy of Rashi. Rashi, in his commentary on the Talmud, actually sticks the following comment in there. He talks about something he calls Niginot Ta'amei Mikra Shel Torah, the musical notations of the Torah, Nevi'im Uktuvim, right, that exist also for books of Nevi'im and Ketuvim, Bein B'nikud Shebasefer, whether they're actually written, obviously not in a Torah scroll, but in what we already know to call a codex, okay? So whether these Ta'amei HaMikra are actually recorded in writing in a codex, Bain, or alternatively, if they're part of an oral tradition, which Rashi calls Hagbahat Kol, raising one's voice, Uvitziltzul Ni'imot HaNigina, or the tziltzul, literally the ringing. So you see that I've used the rather fancy word, tintinabulation, Ni'imot HaNigina of the recitation. And he names four of the Ta'amei HaMikra: Pashta, Darga, Shofar, Mahapach. Now, we know what these are when they're part of the written tradition, but how do you recognize them in an oral tradition? So Rashi makes the following observation. He says, Molich yado lefi ta'am hanigina, that one moves one's hand according to the notations, according to the ta'amim. And Rashi adds that it was not a custom in Ashkenaz, but he says, ra'iti, that he has witnessed this practice, bekor'im haba'im me'eretz Yisrael, that Torah readers who grew up and who learned their trade, so to speak, in the land of Israel, would have these hand motions that accompanied the Ta'amei HaMikra. I've seen that myself. Some of you may have seen it as well. It only it is only can be observed in very rare situations. We had an opportunity last week to point out that Yemenite Jews preserve in their synagogues some very, very old traditions that have been lost elsewhere. The example that we gave last week is the incorporation of the public reading of the Aramaic Targum accompanying the public reading of the Torah. That just as seems to have been during the time of Ezra and during the time of the Talmud, the Torah reader pauses at the end of every sentence while somebody else then reads the Aramaic Targum of that verse. So this is a reference, what Rashi is referring to here, and which Rashi associates with Torah readers from the land of Israel, is also something that one can still observe in certain Yemenite congregations. And that is as follows. Certain Yemenite congregations still preserve the tradition that a person who is called to the Torah is expected to read his own portion. That means that these Yemenite congregations do not have what just about everybody else has, and that is professional Baalei Kriah, right? People who read the Torah, you know, professionally, avocationally, but the people who read the Torah so that in an ordinary congregation, it doesn't matter whether it's Ashkenaz or Sephard, a person is called to the Torah, the person recites the brachot fore and aft, but the actual Torah reading is conducted by this professional, okay? In these Yemenite congregations, and there are very few of them, a person is called to the Torah, and in addition to reciting the brachot before and after, the person reads the portion to which he was called. Now, I suppose that if you're a Kohen or a Levi, so you have a reasonably good idea of what Torah portion you might be called to, so you can actually prepare in advance. But if you're an ordinary Jew, you might be called to any one of several different Torah portions. So how in the world do you know what you're going to be called to? So the answer that they came up with is that the person who in other congregations would be the Torah reader, the Baal Kriah, stands alongside the Torah scroll during the reading. And just like a first base or third base coach in baseball, right, makes certain signals with his hands, with his fingers, or with the movements of his hand. And those signals alert the Torah reader to what the Ta'amei HaMikra are. And this is apparently the custom that Rashi observed amongst what he calls Kor'im Haba'im Me'eretz Yisrael, because he describes as Molich Yado Lefi Ta'am Hanegina, that the person would move his hand in keeping with the trup. Okay. Here is an example out of the very beginning of the Torah of a book that was made in order to facilitate preparation for Torah reading. It's called a tikkun, tikkun kore or tikkun koreim. And what you see here is a printed text of the Torah, complete with the vowels and the punctuation marks on the right-hand side of the page, and the corresponding text as it would appear in an actual Torah scroll, no vowels and no punctuation marks on the left-hand side of the page. Therefore, somebody who knows what Torah portion he has to read, or somebody who is a Baal Kriah and reads the Torah portion regularly, can test his accuracy in both the vocalization and punctuation. And while there are slight variations in classifying or cataloging these punctuation marks, they are generally divisible into five categories, and I've listed them here in descending order of strength, meaning the kesarim, or emperors, are the most emphatic pauses. They are the sof pasuk, the end of a sentence, or et nachta, a large pause in the middle of a sentence. The second category are called melachim, kings, and there is a list of the ta'amim, of the punctuation marks in that category. Below the melachim are sarim, also known in some cases as mishnim. The fourth category is the shalishim, and the lowest category are the misharutim, the servants. So here, on the next two slides, is basically a primer. All you really need to know about Ta'amei HaMikra. I've highlighted two things in it. The primer itself, for those of you who will look later on at the recording, so you can see it then, or you can make a copy of it. Otherwise, I simply lifted it from the book that I've been following since we began these classes, my book on Tanakh and Owner's Manual. I highlighted two portions of it. One, as you see here, is called continuous dichotomy. And this is a very important principle in biblical syntax, and it governs the Ta'amei HaMikra. Continuous dichotomy means that every single biblical verse is divided into two parts, and then each part is subdivided into another two parts, and the process continues until no subdivision contains more than two words. Okay? Hence, dichotomy, splitting things in half, continuous dichotomy, that we continue splitting until we get to the lowest common denominator of a biblical verse, which is a clause or a phrase that consists of no more than two words. Also, please keep in mind that for this purpose, hyphenated words count as a single word. Okay? So here, for example, is one of the early psukim in Bereshit. Okay? The pasuk reads, Vayar Elohim et ha'or, that's hyphenated, okay, et ha'or, ki tov, also hyphenated, Vayavdel Elohim bein ha'or uvein ha'choshech. So let's start with the first dichotomy, the first and major division within a verse is indicated by a change of subject or a change of action. So here we have, Vayar Elohim et ha'or ki tov, God saw the light. And then the action, the verb changes, Vayavdel Elohim, God divided or separated the light from the darkness. So the point at which we have a change of subject or a change of action is the greatest, the largest pause within a verse. And that is governed by one of the kesarim, one of the emperors, the one called an et nachta. The word et nachta itself is Aramaic, but in it you can recognize the word lanuach or the word minucha. It means a rest or a pause. Okay. So now we have the pasuk divided in half. Now I'm on point B if you're following me in this paragraph. We subdivide each of the two major parts into subunits of no more than two words each. So Vayar Elohim et ha'or kitov is four words. So we have to divide this into units of no more than two words each. And that divides, as you see, into Vayar Elohim, that's the subject and the verb, God saw, et ha'or, right? that's the object of the verb, and ki tov is either an adverb modifying the God's looking, or it's an adjective modifying the light. Okay? Then the second half of the verse, Vayavdel Elohim, again, the subject and the verb go together. Bein ha'or uvein ha'choshech, two words to distinguish between or to separate the light from the darkness. Okay? Now, the next part is obviously one only for big fans or aficionados of Tameh HaMikra, because it isn't something that ordinary Torah readers engage in. For an ordinary Torah reader, it should be enough to know that the etnachta, the great pause in the pasuk, follows kitov, and that in reading the second half of the verse, one should say vayavdel Elohim bein haor, slight pause, uvein hachoshech, period. Okay? The parsing of the sentence that you see in the schematic at the bottom of the slide, as I said, is certainly optional for people who are just preparing a Torah reading, but it helps to understand, and it occasionally also gives you insight into the proper interpretation of the verse. So what you see here is, first of all, we've taken each of the two major portions of the verse, and each one is now enclosed with its own little box, okay? So that you see that Vayar Elohim et ha'or ki tov, all is under the same umbrella, so to speak, and that within that larger box, we've taken the beginning, Vayar Elohim et ha'or, the subject, the verb, and the direct object of the verb, and we've placed them under a smaller umbrella and kept them separate from Kitov. While in the second half of the verse, right, we've taken the subject and the verb, okay, and we've kept it separate from what could be the two direct objects of the verb. The second principle of trop of Tameh HaMikra is one that we've already seen illustrated, but here it's just presented formally. And that is that there is a hierarchy amongst the Tameh HaMikra. And we've already taken note of the fact that the end of a complete sentence is marked by the highest order punctuation mark, which is known either as a siluk or a sof pasuk. Okay? And its symbol is a vertical line. If you look at the model, right, just below it, you can see that underneath the word hachoshech, right, is that single vertical line. Should also point out that there are four letters in the word hachoshech, beneath which one would is the sof pasuk placed. It's placed beneath that consonant that carries the accent of the word. So since the word is ha-cho-shech, right, then the proper place for this punctuation mark is below the letter chet. If the punctuation mark were one that goes above the letters rather than below it, if you look a bit to the right, vayavdel Elohim, so you see the two dots above the letter hey, okay, so that too, vayavdel Elohim. That is the letter, or if you wish, the syllable. Thank you. The syllable, right? The accented syllable. So here, the ta'am goes above rather than below. So then again, one of the other functions that the Tameh HaMikra serve, in addition to punctuation and in addition to musical notation, is that it's also an unerring guide to proper pronunciation. Okay? If you want to know how to read a biblical verse properly, how to properly pronounce the words, which words are mila'el, where the accent is toward the beginning of the word, or which words are mila'ra, where the accent is towards the end of the word, okay? then an unerring guide is to simply look at each word and to see where the trap is placed. Okay. A lot more to be said about this, but these, as I said, are the two most important principles. So with that, we can move now to what I've called Masoretic anomalies. Certain features of the Masoretic text that are unusual, or if you wish, and pardon me, anomalous. Starting with kre and ketiv. Kre, from the word to read, means the way a word is pronounced. Ketiv, from the word lichtov, to write, means the way a word is written. Occasionally in Tanakh, a word may be written and spoken in two different ways. And Rabbi David Kimchi Radak, who lived in Provence in the 13th century, and who, in addition to being a grammarian and a biblical exegete, also wrote a manual for scribes, and therefore had a keen interest in all matters Masoretic, gives us in tucked away in his commentary in the book of Samuel is an insight into how it came to pass that there are certain words in the Bible that might be written and read two different ways. And his explanation is a simple historical one. He says that it appears that during the first exile, that would be the Babylonian exile, whatever Torah scrolls or Bible texts that were considered authoritative during the First Temple period were themselves either lost or moved. Right? But either way, the sages, right, the people who knew those texts intimately and might have been able to reproduce them from memory, died. Therefore, when at the beginning of the Second Temple period, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, who tried to restore the Torah text to its previous glory, so they gathered whatever Torah and Bible scrolls they could, but they found that there were differences amongst the remaining scrolls. They weren't all identical. So what process did they follow? They followed a halachic process of majority rules. Right? Therefore, if a clear majority of the scrolls had one reading, as opposed to a different reading in a minority of the scrolls, then they just simply followed the majority reading. However, the Radak says, there were occasions when they were unable to make a determination. Clearly then, maybe the distribution amongst texts did not produce a clear majority. So they were left with the fact that there were two different ways in which a biblical verse had been written. So what did they do? He says that they did one of three things. They either wrote one word, but they didn't vocalize it. And the fact that they didn't vocalize it would call attention to the fact that they were uncertain about it. Or they wrote the word in the margin of the text, but not in the body of the text, which was another way of saying that they were unsure about whether it was correct. Or the most common one, the one that we call kre uketiv. It's not one or the other, something that's written but not read, or read but not written. Okay, and that is where they wrote one of the two versions in the margin and the other of the two versions in the text itself. And here are several examples. Okay, on the right-hand side of the page, of the text from, again, Bereshit Perek Yod Aleph, we have the names of the kings of the five towns. Okay? the king of Sodom, the king of Amorah, the king of Shinab, the king of Adma. And the fifth town in the text itself is spelled Tzadi Vet Yod Yod Mem. If I were to be asked to vocalize that, I would say Tzviyim, Tzvoyim, okay? But you see that in the margin of the text, the word is not only spelled differently, but it's given a very clear vocalization. And that tells us that the word is to be read Tzvoyim. So clearly, according to Radak, this is an instance in which Ezra and the members of the Great Assembly found that some Torah scrolls said Tzviyim, other Torah scrolls said Tzvoyim, and this is the way in which they figured out how to preserve both of the alternatives. Same on the left-hand side of the page, an earlier passage in Bereshit, where the word is spelled Hey Vav Tzadi Aleph, which I would read as Hotse, and the marginal note tells me, again, it alters the spelling and the pronunciation, telling me that it should be read Hayse rather than Hotse. And here, on a page from the second book of Samuel, chapter 13 and 14, are actually, you can see there are several such instances of Kray and Ketiv on one page. There are, in fact, more such instances in books of Nevi'im and Ketuvim than there are in the Torah, arguably because greater care was exercised by copyists, by scribes, in copying Torah texts than in copying texts of Nevi'im or Ketuvim. But let's just simply look at the first one here, because it's a double whammy, so to speak. Notice that the word as it's written inside the text is spelled Ayin Mem Yod Chet Vav Resh. While in the margin, the Chet has become a He and the Resh has become a Dalet. Now, you may remember from last week when we did some work on the alphabet, we noted that there are certain letters of the alphabet which, because they are very similar to each other, often get confused one for another. And here we have two such letters, the letter He and the letter Chet, which are nearly identical, and the letters Dalet and Resh that are nearly identical. So sometimes the reason behind a Kray and Ktiv might simply be a scribal problem. I can't tell. Is that a hey? Is that a chet? Is that a dalet? Is that a resh? Or on other occasions, there could be other reasons for it. The second Masoretic anomaly are the so-called floating dots. Here is again a text from Sefer Bereshit. It's describing Jacob's reunion with his brother Esau. Okay. And looking at the right-hand side of the page where we can read it because it has both the vowels and the punctuation marks, it says, Vayarotz Esav likrato vayechabekehu. Esau ran towards Jacob and embraced him. Vayipol al tzavarav vayishakehu. And he fell on his neck or on his shoulders and he kissed him. Arguably, again, it's still Esau. Esau fell on Jacob's neck and kissed him. Vayivku, and both of them burst into tears. So notice that both in the printed text, but more remarkably in the Torah text itself, in the left-hand column, the letters of the word Vayishakehu have dots over them. And these dots are old enough that the early sources, the Talmud and the Midrash, speculate as to what purpose they serve. The Jerusalem Talmud says, wherever the dotted letters are in the minority in a particular word, then dorat doresh et hakitav umisalek et hanekuda. Meaning, if there are more letters in a word that don't have dots, then there are letters then that have dots, then focus on the letters without the dots and ignore the dots. Okay? Or vice versa. Whenever the dotted letters are in the majority, focus on the dotted letters and ignore the letters without dots. So arguably then, what's the purpose of the dots? The purpose of the dots is to call attention to something. Okay. The Avot Rabbi Natan, a relatively early Midrash, has a different take on the floating dots. According to the Midrash, okay, Ezra, whom we just noted a moment ago, right, stood at the head of the attempt to restore biblical texts to their original accuracy. Okay. Why did Ezra put dots over certain letters? Ezra said, if Elijah, that would be the Elijah the prophet, should eventually say, why did you write those letters? I mean, they don't belong there. They're a mistake. I shall say to him, I put dots over them. Meaning, according to this Midrash, the function of the dot is not to call attention to something, but rather it's a mark of erasure. Therefore, if Elijah were to say to Ezra, these letters are a mistake, Ezra will say, God, so Duncan, thank goodness I put dots over them. Okay. However, if Elijah should say just the opposite, he should say, those letters are correct. No big deal, says Ezra. What'll I do? Hareni misalek nukudot hehen. I'll simply take out my trusty eraser and I'll erase the dots. So we see that there are two different approaches to the function of, in the early sources, to the function of the dots. Interestingly, modern scholars have pointed out that the same dotted notation, called a diple, was used by Greek manuscript copiers in the Hellenistic period to mark questionable parts of a text. Pretty much like the Midrash seems to say. The custom first developed in Alexandria, which was a great center of Jewish learning as well. And the speculation is that it was borrowed from the Greeks by Jewish Torah scribes, right? And if you look on the bottom, the late professor Saul Lieberman wrote a book called Hellenism in Jewish Palestine about things Hellenistic as they are reflected in early Mishnaic and Talmudic sources, noted that dots were sometimes used by Greek copyists not to question the authenticity of something, but rather, just as we saw in the passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi, to tell the reader to pay special attention to it, much as today we might use either italics or put an exclamation point in brackets. And here is an example. Okay, that's the word that we saw in the Torah text with the dots above it, Vayishakehu, describing Esau's hugging and kissing Jacob. And here's the commentary of Rashi. Rashi says, V'yesh cholkim bidavar, that there are different opinions about the function of the dots. Yesh shedarshu nekuda zo lomar, there are those who understand the function of the dots to mean, shelo nishako b'chol libo, that the reason that they put dots over it was to tell you there's something, it's a note of skepticism, right? It's to tell you there's something, you know, a little fishy about this. That yes, maybe if you were filming it, you saw Esau kissing Jacob on his cheek. But we know that this was only an external sign, but it really wasn't wholehearted. Okay? While the alternative interpretation is that, no, quite to the contrary, the dots are there as exclamation points to tell you that at this moment, Esau was so moved by Jacob's treatment of him that on this occasion, he really did hug and kiss him wholeheartedly. So we see that in the Jewish exegetical tradition, we've seen both approaches taken. One that says there's something odd about these letters. They may not belong. And another one that says, no, quite to the contrary, it's to call attention to them. The next phenomenon are one size doesn't fit all. There are a number of occasions, both in the Torah as well as in other books of the Bible, where letters are either larger than usual, smaller than usual, or incomplete. So here we have an example of each. The very first letter of the Torah, the bet of the word Breshit, is larger than usual. It's called an Ot Rabati. The technical term for it is majuscule. In the second chapter of Bereshit, we have the word Bihi Bar'am, in which the letter He is smaller than usual. Technical term for it is minuscule. And in towards the end of the book of Bimidbar, in describing the covenant of Kehuna that God granted to Pinchas, the son of Elazar, it's called a Brit Shalom, and the Vav of the word Shalom is incomplete. It's called an Ot Ketu'ah, an interrupted letter. As you can see, the Vav, right, has a break in the middle. Okay. Here is a completely different phenomenon. It's a floating letter, or if you wish, a letter in suspension. Okay, in the 18th chapter of the book of Shofetim, Judges, there's a story about somebody named Micha who erected a pestle, an idol, that became a thorn in the side of the people of Israel. And it says that the children of Dan erected this pestle, this idol, and they hired people to be its kohanim, its priests. And it names the principal kohen of this idol, Yehonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. But notice oddly that the nun of the word Menashe is not on the same line as the rest of it. And therefore the question is, why was it put into suspension, so to speak? So take a moment and consider, what would the word be if the nun weren't there? Do you know a proper noun in Hebrew that's spelled mem shin hey? Well, I certainly do. Little humor there, of course, right? Right? It would be Moshe. So take a look at, again, how the Talmud Yerushalmi interprets that suspended nun. He says, nun talui, that the nun is suspended, to tell us, im zacha, that if this Yonatan ben Gershom would actually become a meritorious, meaning if he would repent and he would abandon the practice of idolatry, then he would be remembered as a descendant of Moses, which he was. Okay. Otherwise, if, however, he persisted in his function as a priest to a forbidden idol, then the nun would remain and he would be considered the son of Menashe. That means that his relationship to Moses would be obscured. The last one that I want to look at, I think, are the inverted nuns. Okay? You recognize the words, right? Vayhi bin soa haron, vayomer Moshe, kuma Hashem, v'yafutzu oyevecha, v'yanusu misanecha mipanecha. Okay? These two verses, and this is, as you see, this is out of the Torah text itself, okay? So not only, again, in the printed text, but in the Torah scroll itself, these two psukim are set off, both fore and aft, by an inverted nun, or a backwards nun. Now, if backwards nuns kind of look like square brackets, that indeed seems to be the function that they served. And again, Saul Lieberman in his book, Hellenism in Jewish Palestine, brings evidence of the use of these marks, sigla, by Hellenistic scribes. But what function do they serve? The Babylonian Talmud in Masechet Shabbat explains as follows. Okay. Tanur Rabbanan, the sages taught us that the Holy One, blessed is He, made signs, right? Simanim, for this portion, for these two biblical verses, milma'ala ulamata, right? Fore and aft. Why? To teach us lomar she'ein ze mekoma, right? That they don't really belong here. They interrupt the flow, the narrative flow. Okay? That means that I've got to come up with an explanation of why the narrative flow was interrupted. Okay? And most of the exegetes say because what precedes it is a description of one of the many times in which the children of Israel misbehaved. What follows it is an instance of misbehavior. And therefore, the purpose of the interruption was to simply give us a pause, right, to reflect on the two instances that preceded and followed it. Okay, so this is one interpretation. However, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi disagreed, and he said, no, that's not the function of the upside down nuns, but rather it's to indicate that this is Sefer Chashuv Bifnei Atzmo, that these two verses constitute an independent book. Independent book? Interesting. In fact, it continues and it says that Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman said in the name of Rabbi Yonatan, citing a verse in the book of Proverbs, Chatzava amudeha shiv'a, that wisdom built its house, and its house rested on seven pillars. Okay. He interprets this homiletically to refer to, and look at this, right? Shiv'a Sifrei Torah. Not the five books of the Torah, but the seven books of the Torah. Because if in fact these two verses are an independent book, it means that whatever precedes them in the book of Bimidbar is a separate book, and whatever follows them in the book of Bimidbar is a separate book. Which means that the book that we call Bimidbar consists not of one book, but actually consists of three books. Okay, so those three, together with Breshit, Shmot, Vayikra, and Devarim, would make up a total of seven, which is clearly just a homily and not really more than that. Okay. The very last item on our agenda for this evening is something called Tikkunei Soferim. Three Midrashim, the Mechilta, the Sifrei, and the Tanchuma, all venerable Midrashim, right, record among them 18 instances, not in the Torah alone, but throughout the 24 books of Tanakh, of a phenomenon that they call Tikkun Soferim. Literally, Tikkun is to correct a mistake. Sofer is a scribe. So literally, the word tikkun soferim means a scribal emendation or correction. Okay. Nevertheless, as we'll see in a moment, the term was understood traditionally not to be an actual correction of a mistake or a physical change in the text, but rather was understood to be a figure of speech that designates a euphemism. Here's the example. You may remember the story of Abraham extending his hospitality to his three guests. And after he feeds them, it says that they turned away and they headed towards Sodom while Abraham was still standing before God. Now, if you remember the story, right? God appeared to Abraham at the very beginning. Vayera Hashem al Avram, Avraham. God appeared to Abraham. But after that original appearance of God, right, Abraham runs to greet his guests. He goes to give instructions to Sarah. He goes to give instructions to his household. He feeds his guests. So what's this business about Abraham still standing before God? He wasn't standing before God. Actually, the way the rabbis read the text is that when God and Abraham were talking to each other, and Abraham saw that he had visitors, Abraham said to God, "Excuse me, I have to go extend my hospitality to my guests." The rabbis say, "Gedola hachnasat orechim mikabbalat pnei hashechina." This teaches us that extending hospitality takes precedence even over speaking to God. So at that moment in time that Abraham turned away from God to go take care of his guests, what was God doing? The rabbis say that what God was doing was God was standing there waiting for Abraham to finish his duties as a host and then resume their conversation. So actually, the verse should have said, Hashem odenu omed lifnei Avraham, that God was still waiting for Abraham. But that was considered to be unseemly, right? And therefore, from the very moment that the Torah was written, it was written as though it were Abraham who was still standing before God, not that a text was altered or amended, but rather from the very beginning, it spoke euphemistically, indirectly. Same example, another example here, but we don't have time. The actual form that Masoretic notes takes consists of two apparatuses. One is called the Misora Ketana, lesser Misora, and that appears, it's a series of abbreviations that appear in the margin of a printed text of Tanakh. And the other is called the Misora Gedola, the greater Masora, and that consists of explanations of the abbreviations, and it appears in one of the other upper or lower margins of a printed text. Here's an example. I show you. The example is coming from a book that I happen to have on my shelf. The only text of Tanakh that I happen to have that has Masoretic notes is an edition of Sefer Tehillim, which, as you can see, was published in Venice in 1618. And here is the opening page, right? The very first chapter of the Book of Psalms. So you can see on the bottom on the right-hand side is the Masoretic text. Ashrei ha'ish asher, sorry, it's cut off. Lo halach ba'atzat rishaim uvederach hata'im lo amad, etc. Right? To its left, right, the left-hand column is the Aramaic Targum of Psalms. In the middle, between those two, you can see abbreviations, right? There's a letter bet on the top line. Below it, there is a letter dalet, a letter kaf, right? A bunch of abbreviations, okay? So here are the abbreviations that you would find in a comparable text accompanying the very first pasuk of the Torah. Breshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. You'd find the following notes. You'd find a letter he. Following it, you'd find a letter gimel. Then the words rosh pasuk. Then another gimel and a lamed. That's the Misora Ktana. That's the abbreviated way. The Misora Gedola explains, right, elaborates on those abbreviations and tells us that the He means that the word Bereshit appears five times in the Bible. Of those five times, Gimel, three of them, Rosh Pasuk, are at the very beginning of a verse, as it is here at the beginning of the Torah. And then it tells you what those verses are. Breshit bara Elohim, right? Then Breshit mamlachot and Bremishit mamlechet. Again, it doesn't give you all the information, but if you had a concordance, you could find them. And what about the two remaining uses of the word Breshit? Those are be'emtza. That's where the word Breshit appears not at the beginning of a pasuk, but somewhere else in the pasuk. Again, in those same verses. Okay? And finally, you see on the bottom of the page, the word Gimel, the letter Gimel, tells us that the phrase Bavra Elohim appears three times in the Bible. And the Lamed is perhaps even the most interesting of all of the Masoretic notes. The Lamed is an abbreviation for the Aramaic word Leta, which means no is. Okay? And that tells us that a word or a combination of words that are marked Masoretically with the Lamed means that that word or that combination of words appears nowhere else in Tanakh. And there we are for this evening. I will take a quick look. Oh, I have this problem again that I haven't been able to solve. You'll forgive me. It'll take me a moment because I cannot somehow on my computer, the chat got scrunched. So I don't get more than four letters on a line.
I can read the questions if you'd like.
Oh, please. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I guess I can ignore my comment. But I'm assuming the Yemenites, they still read the Targum in Aramaic.
Right? Oh, yes. It's a boy of about bar mitzvah age who accompanies the Koray. And there's trop for the Targum also, meaning it's read musically.
So I have to go to a Yemenite shul, but
Yemenite shul will have it.
Yeah, I mean, that custom, of course, is a Talmudic custom that went for a long time, but now I think they're the Yemenites, the only one who keep it going. Okay, which version is more correct, the Kri or the Kriv?
Well, according to the Radak, it shows basically that the sources were split on it.
Okay.
I'm assuming that the one that they want you to read, to recite, may have been considered slightly more authoritative because they were clearly more concerned about the proper recitation of the text. Because remember that likro in biblical Hebrew means to recite. When we say read something, our automatic assumption is that you're going to sight read it. In fact, you may remember from school that you were probably criticized on one occasion or another. Why are you moving your lips when you're reading? So we have to remember that in biblical Hebrew, and not only in the biblical period, but halachically, anything that's supposed to be read halachically has to be recited. So I'm assuming that whatever version they wanted you to recite was the one that they somehow thought was slightly more authoritative. But that's just
I would think it's connected to the Machloket and Masechet Sukkah, Yeshem Lemikra, Yeshem Lemasoret. In other words, which the Gemara has that debate by how many wads you need in a Sukkah. Do you read it with the Vav or without the Vav? Sukkot spelled with or without a Vav. How you pronounce it or how it's written. So I don't know. Yeah, you don't think that's connected?
That's usually when the difference is one of the Imot HaKriyah. I think it's really different if the difference is in vocalization and not in the consonantal text. But anyhow.
Okay. iPad wants to know, okay, I guess changing the Torah text, not because it's scribal doubt, but to reflect textual interpretation. Or what came first here, I think that's the question. But the idea that here you have the text was changed by Chazal or by somebody,
again, according to the Radak's explanation and according even to the explanation that's provided for Tikkuni Sofrim, no text was ever changed. The understanding that a Tikkun Sofrim is not a change in the text, it is the use of a euphemistic speech. But nevertheless, if you want to know more about correcting, fixing text, I refer you to the work of my colleague Barry Levy called Fixing God's Torah.
I have in the back if you're right. Okay. All right. Obviously, I'll just ask you, the Radak clearly doesn't hold like the Rambam in terms of our biblical text. I mean, that's rather obvious. He can't hold like the Rambam, that the Torah text that we have today is the same one given at Sinai. That's a much broader topic, but the Radak basically says black and white. We lost our Masorah. And the dots, while you were talking on the dots, I pulled out Weiss HaLivni's book, Pshat HaDrash, which I read about 25 years ago, David Livni Weiss. You're familiar with this, Dr. Sokolow? I assume you have it too, yes. A classic. This is plain and applied meaning in rabbinical exegesis, right? Okay, so this is where he has a long discussion. I haven't read it in 20 years. I'll have to take a look at it again. But of course, he goes into great depth that Pirkei, the Avot de Rabbi Natan, obviously is very controversial. They don't like it in the yeshiva world because it doesn't flow with the current theological assumptions of how the Torah were put together. But okay, anyways, thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you next week. And I want to thank you, and I want to thank the Almonds again. And if I can, I'm going to make a plug. I haven't done it. It's towards the year end. If anybody would like to make a donation, that would be greatly appreciated. The sponsor class, or low, whatever you can do, I think is greatly appreciated. Just put a link to the donate page. And as you know, all our classes are offered free of charge, but they don't run for free of charge. So if you can, those who have given, we thank you very much. And we appreciated all donations. And most of them, we look forward to learning with you and your friends. And please invite them tomorrow night. Rav Avia Tabori, he's wants to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to give the shiur 3:30 live from a lunch route. That's his choice. So that's tomorrow. Rav Avia Tabori will be giving the shiur 8:30 on Parshat Shmot. We've entered the next book of the Torah, of course. And then Friday morning at 9 a.m., I'll be continuing my shiur on the Siddur. So everybody's welcome, and we look forward to seeing you. Everybody should be well, should be safe. I just saw the British first study, I think, came out that Omicron is less severe, which we've all been hoping for. Let's hope it's really true, and that all the increased cases won't mean increased people who are sick. Okay, everybody, we will. Thank you very much. Laila Tov.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thank you again, Rabbi Amin. Okay, thank you.